If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Rakuten.com.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
In 2001 in Dundee, Scotland, a woman walking her dog was brutally stabbed and stamped to death. Police assumed a maniac stalker must be responsible, but when the true perpetrator was identified, it shocked the nation. A 15-year-old boy with no previous convictions. 16 years later, after more than half a lifetime in prison, he'd be given a second chance at freedom, only to reoffend in the most brutal of ways. This is what happens when a natural-born psychopath cannot be reformed. This is the case of Robbie McIntosh. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case I've been asked to cover. I have a list, as you know, that you guys have sent me, and I'm going through it. This case is truly horrendous. I'd heard about the recent one that I'm going to cover within this, but actually I was unaware of the historical offending of this particular perpetrator. I think you're going to be really interested in this. And also I think it's going to pose some really important questions. We've just covered the case of Charles Bronson, who has not been allowed out of prison. So this guy has been in prison for 5 decades and they don't think he's safe to be released. He's never killed anyone. I'm not trying to suggest that he's been a good old boy. Please watch my coverage of Charles Bronson if you haven't. What I'm saying is it's kind of a bit mind-blowing when I hear about cases of individuals being released from prison who seem to be so much more dangerous. And over time, in this case, a very short time, it's proven that they are still incredibly dangerous, and yet they're walking our streets. I want to take you back to 2001. This is where it all begins. We've got 15-year-old Robbie McIntosh. Now, he's living with his mother because he's a young man. She's called Heather, and he's living in Kenmore Terrace in Dundee, Scotland. Now, this kid had no previous convictions, but what I would say is you always know in your local area, don't you, a kid who, shall we say, is rotten to the core. Sorry, no other way of phrasing it. You know that kid who, no matter what, no matter how they're parented, no matter who they're surrounded by, there just seems to be this thread that runs within them that is going to cause problems societally. That's who I am describing when I'm talking about Robbie McIntosh. So even though he's never been criminalised, he's got a really bad reputation in the local area. And I would say he's the kind of kid that if you saw him, you're going to cross the road. You want to make sure you're on the other side of the street. And the kids that he hung around with, you will absolutely anticipate and understand, also were individuals who had a similar reputation. People described him as being very sullen, withdrawn, and he was very much known to cause trouble when he didn't get his own way. I think we can all appreciate that lots of teenagers are sullen and withdrawn. I may have had one of those myself at some points in the past. But the point is that he is an individual with a character that people struggle to like. There's something generally unpleasant about him. And the truth is, people were absolutely right to have that instinct around him, because even though at this point no one was aware, he was an extreme sexual sadist. Now, bear in mind, we're talking about a 15-year-old young man. That is deeply troubling. And we talk about sociopathy and psychopathy, but let's just look at sociopathy being something that happens after you're born. So your society, your environment, your family basically activates those factors and creates that situation, versus a psychopath who is born cold-blooded and essentially they're always going to turn out that way. Essentially, I think that when we're talking about a 15-year-old who's already very much into extreme sexual sadism, we're kind of looking more, in my opinion, at a cold-blooded psychopath. Just putting it out there early. He definitely derived pleasure and sexual pleasure from other people's physical and psychological suffering. He was particularly interested in extreme violence against women. And this is really important to note, because everybody has different opinions on pornography. I fully appreciate that lots of consenting adults of appropriate ages use pornography as sexual stimulation and also use it at times in relationships, but I have a huge issue with extreme pornography. I have lots of issues with that for lots of different reasons, but believe me, when young men in particular are growing up watching very sadistic pornography towards women, and that's how they're essentially reaching climax, believe me, when they get into their actual intimate relationships, we see big problems, including guys who actually can't get hard-ons anymore because they need people to look like they're suffering to enjoy it. And I have a real belief that as a society that's developed, we should certainly know about this impact and even more so try to regulate the types of pornography that people are allowed to see, because it's not good for people. That's what I'm saying. And that's what the evidence also says. But he is very much engaged with this. And obviously, we're talking about a time where it is easy to access online. So when they actually looked at this guy's computer hard drive, it's reflected that he is very much engaged in this particular area of sadistic and sexual behavior. Now, up until this point in his life, I would say there is an absolutely clear distinction between what we're going to talk about in a moment, which is his ideas around sexual sadism. It's very much confined to the realms of fantasy. But that's about to change. And this is why, obviously, we can't say that all pornography is going to incite this kind of terrible behaviour I'm going to talk about in a moment. What I would say is, if an individual has this kind of predilection and becomes more and more fixated on this particular kind of material, and it doesn't serve their purposes enough, then there is possibly going to be that tipping off, that deciding, well, maybe if I actually put it into a reality base, then it will fulfill my dark fantasies. And that's why we've got to be really careful about this stuff. So we've got 34-year-old civil servant Anne Valerie Nicole. Now, she is the youngest of three sisters. She was actually described by people who knew her as a delightful person. I think that's such a gorgeous description. You don't really need very more traits to be evidenced when somebody describes somebody as delightful. But she was lovely, caring, sensitive. She's a really fun individual as well. She's literally the polar opposite to McIntosh. But unfortunately, as we know, there are sliding doors moments in everybody's lives. And for this particular woman, who's adored by the people who know and love her, her path is going to cross with McIntosh, unfortunately, in August 2001, and it's going to, on this occasion, have deadly consequences. And to describe that this is a bolt out of the blue is an absolute understatement. So this is how it plays out. On the 2nd of August 2001, McIntosh basically leaves his home. It's around 6 p.m. in the evening. And at this point, he makes his way alone to Dundee Law Hill. Now, this is a really popular, commonly used recreation area, lots of dog walkers, obviously kids meeting each other and so on and so forth. Now, simultaneously, we have Anne. She's setting off from the family home and she's going to go and walk her dog, Sophie, and she's going to do that on Law Hill. Now, she's walking through this very densely wooded area. It's adjacent to the path, which leads from Law Crescent to Law Road. And at this point, she actually realises that she recognises someone. So she sees McIntosh. She notices that he's smoking a joint. And like a lot of adults, we have our judgment calls. We have the way that we believe the world should work. And she is a little bit taken aback by the fact that McIntosh is smoking a joint. So she goes up to him, approaches him, and she basically makes her disapproval clear. She also says that she might tell his mother if he doesn't stop. And his mother's actually a social worker at Castle Huntly Prison. So we can see that the likelihood is that McIntosh has been brought up in quite a pro-social environment, probably been brought up in an environment where his mother has got some really good morals, etc. And the very fact that this incident involves him being threatened because mum's going to disapprove, again, that identifies that he's probably being brought up in a really good home. But he's really angry about this. And Anne has no idea. She thinks that she's just berating a 15-year-old young man about making better choices in his life and also about helping him understand the impact that this might have on his home life and the relationship that he has with his mother, who's going to be disappointed by these actions. But there is no way, and I mean absolutely no way whatsoever, that she could ever have anticipated McIntosh's reaction. Nor could she have known at the time when she has that altercation with him, could she have been aware that he's actually armed with a knife. And he just loses it. He just flies into this uncontrollable rage and he just begins this brutal, frenzied assault on Anne. And it's even where he stabs her that kind of provokes a reaction within me that is quite unusual, because we often read about this in the press or we'll watch it in documentaries. When people stab another human being, often it's around the chest area because you're basically looking at wanting to end their life. But when he stabs Anne, he repeatedly stabs her on the head. I mean, he stabs her in the body as well, but the head, it's a dehumanizing.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Way of attacking someone, because your face is very indicative of who you are. It's what people relate to, it's what people recognize. And when somebody basically assaults that area of your body, it makes you unrecognizable on lots of levels. And it's also an area that we have our eyes, our nose, our mouth. These are such pivotal parts of being a human being that represent who we are. And the fact that he's quite happy to stab her in the head and the body. And one of the stab wounds actually goes through her voice box. And that's just so sad, because that means that she can't scream for help. And it also means that she ends up frothing blood from her mouth. So this is a really brutal reality that she's suffering in those last moments of her life. Now, once he gets her on the ground, he's not finished. So then he starts to stamp on her head, on her face, on her body. And again, that's the eradication of the humanity. And it demonstrates there is something incredibly rageful bubbling within him. He's just looking at a way to externalize whatever those feelings are within him as a human being. Now, when they do the autopsy, they actually establish that Anne had been stabbed 29 times. That's a huge amount of injury for anybody to bear. And obviously, in this case, it's completely unsurvivable. And after he's done this, and bear in mind what we've just talked about, she just got into a conversation with him, gave him a bit of a lecture on making better choices in his life. And yes, saying, I'll tell you, mum. But you know, who hasn't said that to a young person in these kind of situations? But from that scenario, it's escalated to a point where she's been butchered, her body's been stamped on, and now she's just being left for dead. And he basically leaves her body in bushes, and it's about 100 metres from the path which leads up to Law Hill. After he's finished killing her, McIntosh goes home, and he's obviously got some understanding of trying to evade any kind of capture. He doesn't want to be apprehended. He's not intending to get caught for this crime, because he goes back and he showers, changes his clothes. So that's going to put some distance, hopefully, for him between the crime scene and him being involved in that crime. And then after he's done that, he's not unhappy. He's not disturbed. He's not traumatized. He's not remorseful. He's not even scared. He just goes back out. Just goes and meets his mates in the park. That's not far from Law Hill. And he's obviously intoxicated. And I'm using that word purposefully, because he's enjoying the fact that he's done this. He's liking the knowledge that he's carrying that no one else has. He's not trying to avoid the reality. He's not trying to deny to himself that that's actually just happened. No, he wants more of it. So at some point, he leaves his friends and he goes into the children's playground, which is literally overlooking the murder scene. And he just watches. He just waits patiently, because he knows at some point someone's going to find her body. And he just calmly watches as the events unfold. Now, obviously, Anne was meant to be on a relatively short dog walk. And after more than an hour has passed and she's failed to return home, her family get really worried, because she's somebody who's quite habitual. So her boyfriend, a guy called Gordon McKenzie, he goes out to Law Hill to look for her. He's concerned. Now, bear in mind, we have McIntosh just sat waiting, watching. And he's doing this because he wants to see how the horror of this loss plays out in real time. So from his vantage point in the playground area, McIntosh watches as Gordon searches for Anne, all the while knowing what Gordon's going to find. He literally witnesses the moment that Gordon finds the woman that he loves butchered, mutilated in the undergrowth. He watches as, in absolute distress, Gordon walks away from the scene, just in total shock, to phone the police. And he continues watching Gordon as he falls apart, as he breaks down in tears, as the reality of the situation sinks in and he realises that this woman that he loves, she's never coming home. McIntosh evidently gained immense satisfaction just witnessing the impact of his crime. It's not just about the killing for him, it's about the ripple effect of that killing and the fact that he was able to be there watching his work unfold in the trauma of the individuals witnessing it. I mean, the malevolence in the nature of a human being like that, it's rare. Even when we think about some of the worst serial killers in the world, often they leave the scene, they're not returning, they're not waiting. And yes, they like to be forensically involved, but they're not necessarily that interested in seeing that moment where the method of their killing is discovered by somebody who loves that individual who's now been lost. So the police are understandably very quickly at the scene. Murder investigation is launched immediately because there's absolutely no way whatsoever that this is a natural death. And the police immediately think, well, this is an absolutely brutal type of killing. You could almost imagine that there was some kind of connection, because what we'll see, particularly in cases of overkill, where somebody is stabbed so brutally, particularly in the case of overkill with dehumanisation, which we're talking about, because obviously her face has been badly attacked, he's stamped on her body, stamped on her head. Often there is an emotional connection. So a sense of it could be a maniac stalker, and that's what they think. This is somebody who's probably been looking for this person, building something up in their mind, and then consequentially acting from that place of emotional issue. But they've got it wrong. You can see this is because it's rare. It's so unusual for somebody to just kill a completely innocent human being out of the blue, particularly when we think about what actually occurred to create that altercation and the consequential death. Now, the police, in their wildest nightmares, when they're starting to conceive of a potential profile of this killer, they're not thinking it's a 15-year-old boy who has never been on the police radar. Yes, he's not a good kid. Yes, people don't like him. Yes, people have concerns when they're around him because they think there's something dark within his nature, but they're not thinking this is a kid who could actually go out and do what I've just described. Officers start doing the good old police work we expect, so they start speaking to a number of witnesses, and the witnesses are quite forthcoming. So they said, yeah, you know what? We did see somebody before the murder, around the time of the murder, or just before. And we know that it was a youth. We know he was dressed in a blue tracksuit. Also, he had a blue baseball cap on. And they said that the reason that they noticed him was because he was kind of moving around Law Hill on his own. And even though young people clearly walk places by themselves, there must have been something about his actions or his movements that provoked that connection. Again, we're seeing that instinctual connection. Because you see people all the time, but there's something about the way that he moves, there's something about the way he walks, there's something about the way that he is that just alerts them. So investigators are pretty soon able to kind of put a profile together of what this youth looked like, and they realise pretty quickly that this is really similar clothing to that that was regularly worn by McIntosh. I mean, kids do dress in certain ways, don't they? I think about my own youngest child, for example, and I think back to the times when he went through a particular period where he looked like a street rat. For those of you who don't know what that means, it's not the most commendable way of looking. You basically look like somebody who might mug you at any point. He wouldn't. It was just fashion. Just a really terrible phase that I'm very glad he's over with now. But they're starting to realise, well, this could actually be related to this teenager, or this teenager may well have some information that we need to find out about because he could have been a witness to this situation. Now, the witnesses said that when they saw him, they actually immediately became suspicious of him. It was the way that he stared at them. It made them really anxious. And that, I believe, is quite provocative as a statement, because I think that it's not necessarily that he was looking for her as a victim. I think the likelihood is he was looking at anybody that day as a potential victim. Bear in mind, he had a knife with him. Bear in mind, he was looking to be antagonistic. And bear in mind that all these people are saying there was something really unusual about him, threatening about him even. It made us anxious. So I believe that any individual could have been his victim that day. Now, one witness, they were able to actually identify McIntosh specifically as being the person that she'd seen. Now, this is great for the police because they've either got a suspect or they've got somebody who might be able to help them in their inquiries. Now, we've had McIntosh at the murder scene, essentially, looking over it at least. And this is something that is unbelievable because after leaving the murder scene, he basically goes to a local chip shop. I mean, is it just me who finds that just so grotesque? One of the things that you would imagine, at least, as a reality of the actions we've talked about, would be a lack of appetite. But not for McIntosh. No, absolutely not. And it's typical of those with psychopathic mindsets, because it is an ability to function even when our conscience should be telling us that we should no longer be able to. We should be rendered absolutely helpless in the throes of the actions that I've talked about, but no. McIntosh shows that pure, cold psychopathy. He can just go to the chip shop, get himself a bag of chips, and also he can express what he's seen because he can't contain his excitement. Absolutely unbelievably excited by what's played out. Excited because he thinks he's outsmarting people. He's unable to actually keep it down and keep it secret what's happened. He has to tell people about this horrific crime, and he actually tells the two staff at the chip shop that a woman's been murdered on Law Hill, tells them that she's been stabbed to death. But these are people who work in the locality, they work in the chip shop, they've heard absolutely nothing about this murder. It's not on the news, it's not in the media, because it's not public knowledge. And yet we've got this cocky, confident, excited teenager buying a bag of chips and actually describing, basically in detail, what's just played out. And his description of the crime was so, so direct and descriptive and connected that the staff actually become suspicious. And boy, do these staff become suspicious, because a lot of people can have conversations, right? I mean, they talk to people every day of the week, and that's probably why they're very diligent about being able to decipher what they consider a typical versus an atypical conversation. And they're so concerned and perturbed and disturbed by this conversation through this youth that they actually contact the police and they give them Macintosh's details. And that's so powerfully important to just work on the theory that forms in your mind where you think, this feels too personal. He knows too much. And his attitude is incongruent with what he's actually describing. And to then go and call the police is an amazing act of civil duty. It really is. So we get to 2 days after the killing. This is the 4th of August, 2001. Macintosh again, just can't keep it in. He is absolutely thrilled by his actions, without a doubt. He cannot contain that excitement about the murder. So he ends up talking to his friend, a guy called Kenneth Craig Brown. And he tells his friend that he'd basically been alone at the park and he'd actually seen Anne's partner walking up the path and he'd witnessed him finding her body. Now, as previously in the chip shop, what he's talking about shows that he's got this kind of special knowledge about the circumstances as to how the body was found. And this was not public knowledge at the time. And I guess as well for his friend, it would be listening to him talk about it in a very personal way, an excited way, but also without any empathy, because we're not hearing empathy. He's not saying, I'm really traumatized. I saw the most horrific moment where a man discovered somebody he loves dead and I don't know how to process this information. No, he's happy about it. He's got one up on everybody else because he was there witnessing it. Now, of course, there's been a lot of descriptions at this point that have been handed over from witnesses. Also, we've got the tip off about Macintosh by the chip shop. So the police at this point go and speak to him, but he's not there at the time. Now, they find out that he's actually at Glasgow Airport. And you can understand in that moment in time, they're thinking this is a kid who's a flight risk. He's trying.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
To flee the country. So officers basically descend on the international terminal and they actually apprehend Macintosh there. Now, it turns out he's not on the run, actually. He was just saying goodbye to his sister because she's going back to fly to Canada. But you can understand that they're really concerned at this moment in time because if he leaves the country, it's going to be really difficult for them to find him. The police then go and search his home and it's so incriminating. So first of all, the night of the killing, Macintosh has basically tried to wipe the content of his computer hard drive. So we're seeing that he's thinking about consequential reality. How do I prevent myself being seen as a potential suspect? I know, I'll get rid of all the grotesque information that's on my hard drive. It also suggests that there is a part of his brain that's saying, I feel that the police are going to pinpoint me as a potential suspect, because he wouldn't have acted that way otherwise. So I think part of it is to do with just being secure as far as he's concerned regarding preventing apprehension. But another side of it is maybe people will have seen me and I need to do my due diligence to prevent the police then connecting the dots. But of course, at the end of the day, there are forensic computer experts, aren't they? They can dig up anything from your computer hard drive. I worry about it. Can you imagine the type of research I do on my phone and on my computer? If it isn't bad enough, then I have quite a lot of books on things like the occult and spells, because I like books on lots of different areas. Then if the police were to seize those and my phone, they would be like, she is definitely guilty of the crime. Look at the content of her world. But at the end of the day, I'm not a 15-year-old boy who essentially should not be looking at the material I'm going to outline shortly. But those forensics can bring back all the details, and they do. And it's really alarming, so it absolutely identifies that fascination he's got with violence against women. There's a large number of downloads from sites that are all concerned with violent rape. Also, there's material depicting the rape of children. This boy may only be 15, but he is a sexual predator towards children. Yes, he's not had a contact crime, as in he's not physically, as far as we are concerned, been involved in child molestation. But if you are viewing that material, you are a child molester. I don't care that there's been no contact. You are inciting a reality of creating this material and disseminating it to others. There is a need for that material because of absolute horrors that I'm describing where McIntosh is concerned. He is one of those individuals who creates a need for this kind of absolutely despicable material. But there you can see, when you add all that together, we're just dealing with a sexual sadist, pure and simple. So the police then take McIntosh's clothing for forensic testing because they want to be able to try to link him to the scene of the crime. This actually includes a torn and a bloodstained t-shirt. So that's indicative of a struggle, and it's highly atypical to be found in anybody's room. And at this point, they arrest McIntosh on suspicion of Anne's murder, and they remand him in custody because clearly he's a horrific danger to humanity, without a shadow of a doubt. When it comes to the police interview, this happens on the 4th of August 2021, McIntosh has obviously had time to think. Of course he has. We're not dealing with somebody who's stupid here. This guy's manipulative. He's thinking on his feet. He's figuring out, how am I going to make this fit in accordance with my set of circumstances in my brain that will afford me an opportunity to evade apprehension? How can I create a story that feels like it could have happened, maybe connects me a little bit with the crime, but doesn't actually implicate me in the behaviour? So he decides to tell the detectives that he was alone on Law Hill. This is on the evening of the murder. Claims that he'd been walking up it about 5 p.m. or just shortly after. And then during this time, he said, I actually did see somebody who looked like Anne. Bear in mind, he knows who Anne is. We already know that she knows his mother, and she was going to tell his mother potentially about the weed smoking. So it wouldn't be somebody resembling Anne. You'd identify that that was Anne. But again, he's trying to distance himself a little bit. So he says, yeah, I did see somebody resembling Anne. And she's speaking to this old lady. And actually, that isn't far from where her body was later found. He also said, look, I also saw this guy who resembled a boyfriend walking towards the murder scene. And he said, I actually saw him on his mobile phone. Then I saw an ambulance come, and I saw the police arriving pretty soon afterwards. And then you guys told me I had to leave the area. So that's the last I kind of saw of it. Now, this is really interesting behaviour. It's superiority personified. Because can we just acknowledge the police have already taken bloodstained clothing from his home? Just going to throw it out there. I mean, he's saying, I've had nothing to do with this. I just kind of witnessed what happened from afar. But they've already taken bloodstained clothing, which is obviously going to be highly incriminating if anything comes back. So this prelude to reality doesn't mean that reality is not going to arrive. So on top of the fact that they've removed this bloodstained clothing from his home, another thing that is quite intriguing is, as opposed to trying to distance himself further, because you would imagine when you've been apprehended by the police and you're being questioned, you're going to want to be like, oh, no, I wasn't anywhere near the scene. I don't know what you're talking about. But he doesn't. He inserts himself within it. He actually puts himself in the place of the unfolding events. And that's highly narcissistic. Literally, that's what we see with organized serial killers. They love to insert themselves forensically in these events. They like to see it play out in real time. They like to follow the investigation. They like to feel that they're one step ahead of the law, but basically they're intoxicated by their actions. And it's almost like he's eager to place himself near that murder scene, claiming that he's seen her before her death, that he's seen what happens after her death. And then they say, look, how come you've got this torn and bloodstained t-shirt? And he's like, okay, that does seem a little bit incriminating, but just go with me on this. Basically, I had a fight with two of my close friends, so a guy called Robert Sutar and Dean Montgomery. So he's got this excuse for why this bloodstained t-shirt would be there. So we get to the 8th of August, 2001. McIntosh again, they interview this young man that's now, as far as they're concerned, a very clear suspect. And they say to him, listen, we're really intrigued about what you said to the staff in the chip shop. You know, you seem to know a hell of a lot of the details that we hadn't actually released to the public. No one is aware of some of the information that you passed on. And he says, hey, I just heard rumours. Small area. People talk. We know each other. I just heard people saying certain things and I passed it on. But again, for the officers, it's too detailed. And as far as they're concerned, the only people who would be aware of actually how this death played out would be her killer or killers. They then get the results of the forensic analysis because obviously they've sent off McIntosh's clothing and it's just further incriminating. I mean, they find two spots of blood in his sock. That's a match for Anne. So now he's clearly been at the scene. And also they find a faint bloodstain on his baseball cap. And when it came down to statistically how likely it was that it was a match for Anne and a match for McIntosh, the probability of that match was 1 trillion to 1. I don't even know how many zeros that involves, but I can tell you that means he's bound to rights. Now, at this point, McIntosh is remanded. He gets remanded in custody in Rossi School. That's a detention centre. It's near Montrose. And it's during this time, of course, he starts to change his story. Don't we love it? When a criminal who thinks they can outsmart the authorities decides that maybe the story hasn't gone quite as well as he thought it was going to do. Let me rethink this story to try to create another story that's going to mean that I don't get apprehended for the crime that I've clearly committed. But anyway, he's had some time, hasn't he? He's been using his little noggin. I used the word little noggin purposely there. And he actually starts to say to this social worker, you know what? I am not prepared to be blamed for this crime that I didn't commit. And the reason I'm not going to get blamed for this crime that I did not, actually I did, commit is I'm going to blame my mate. So this guy who we know is completely guilty of this crime, now it's starting to get a bit real for him. Starting to realise, oh, it's not going to be quite as easy to outsmart the authorities. He's like, I know, I'll just blame my best mate. Seems like the most pro-social thing that I can do. Just drag an innocent party who's had absolutely nothing to do with this crime. And I don't know about you, but could you get more psychopathic than being an individual who has a best friend and then thinking, oh, best friend's always been there for me. Best mates stick together. He won't mind if I just put all the blame on him. So that's what he does. This poor Robert Souter gets blamed by McIntosh for the crime. Now, like McIntosh, he's a teenager. He's also got a bad reputation in the local area. So the police are going to prick up their ears. And McIntosh actually claims that he and Souter have been smoking weed. And then Anne walks past with a dog. Then he says that she makes this comment to Souter about their drug use, which we all know happened. It's just that Souter was not there to witness this. But arguably, he's just basically projecting. So Souter becomes him in this situation. So McIntosh says that Souter, without any warning, basically responds by suddenly attacking Anne, that he stabs her multiple times, and then he just runs away from the area. Now, that's really intriguing, isn't it? Because what we're actually seeing is him fully describe the situation that played out, but he's in the completely different context. So he's taking on the role of witness as opposed to perpetrator. He's the innocent party in the situation. But actually, again, he's reliving the crime itself. He's telling the story of how the crime actually played out. Now, on one level, it's certainly to avoid apprehension. Second level, it's to project blame on somebody else. And most importantly, as far as I'm concerned, it's also to titillate himself once again with the feelings that are provoked by describing the attack per se. Now, McIntosh said, you know, it happened so quickly, I didn't even know it was happening. And even though I'd witnessed this murder, and that's why I was able to then go and tell people about it and describe in detail how it played out at the chip shop, I wasn't the actual person who perpetrated it. Now, the police think that could actually have happened. You know, if you were in that vicinity, you could get blood on you. Certainly if you were in proximity towards the victim, if your friend had just lost the plot and acted out and you're in a situation where you don't know what to do because you're a kid and your mate's with this person, you don't want to get them in trouble, but also you're dealing with the fallout and trauma of what you've just seen, it could be that you'd be talking about it with all these details without actually being guilty. So the police go and search Suter's home, they analyse his clothing, and they find nothing. Absolutely nothing connecting him to the crime. Because poor Suter is completely innocent. Might be a bad lad, might have got into trouble, but at the end of the day, he ain't no murderer. Now, McIntosh at this point says, oh, yeah, you didn't find anything, but you're not going to. Because after he had killed her, he basically goes to his grounds, changes his clothes. So all you've done is gone to an address, look for the clothes that will never be there because he was actually at his grand's. So the police do initially suspect that Suter could be involved. But again, they keep looking closely at him and there's no evidence whatsoever linking him to the crime. And I imagine that Suter is like, oh, he is off the Christmas card list. I always had some concerns and reservations about him as my best mate. But now, let's be clear, he has certainly dropped off the list of the last 2,000 people I would ever invite to my home. Because can you imagine the betrayal that Suter would feel? One, what happens to the old thing about not snitching on your mates? That one's gone for a Burton. And the second one is, at the end of the day, he's actually projected blame and put Suter in a very stressful and difficult situation. And a lot of people always believe there's no smoke without fire. So reputational damage is occurring there as well. So now the police completely discount that Suter's involved and ultimately McIntosh is charged with Anne's murder, and rightly so. They get to the trial. This commences at the High Court in Forfar in April 2002. It's 11 days in total and it takes them 3 hours in deliberation. We all know when a jury only deliberates for 3 hours, it's pretty much an obvious result. They don't feel that they need to question a lot of the information. The prosecution have probably done a really good job, and the jury find 16-year-old McIntosh guilty of murder on the 17th of April 2002. The judge, he subsequently imposed a life sentence and said that he would have to serve a minimum of 15 years. Also worth noting that when the judgment was passed, McIntosh didn't actually display any emotion. He was just totally emotionless in the dock. And when he's led away from the dock, Anne's devastated boyfriend, the man who had traumatically found her body, who will live with the stain of that reality on his conscience for the rest of his life, he's been witnessing this in court, and Gordon McKenzie shouts to McIntosh, "See you when you get out, you bastard." And I think that is such a human response. It's like, okay, they're going to lock you up, but you know, life's long, 15 years will pass, and you better watch every step of the way from the moment that you're free, because I might be coming for you. And I can imagine in that moment, I'd have felt exactly the same. Now, whilst he's in prison, McIntosh actually converts to Islam. He wears a full beard, he's got a skull cap, and allegedly he was actually monitored for possible radicalization. Now, prison officials later denied this, but it's not unusual. I mean, at the end of the day, people do get radicalized in prison. And it's really important to monitor those individuals, particularly when they're a predatory and dangerous individual. But when we look at a 2016 study, this is by Cambridge University, it identified that the reason that a lot of prisoners convert to Islam is actually in an attempt to impose discipline on their lives, to create order and meaning, as opposed to it being about them wanting to be radicalized to go and do awful things. Quite the contrary, it's very much about trying to create habits that are positive and seek a higher meaning. But they don't think that was the case where McIntosh is concerned. In fact, it could be the other motive is that he wanted to convince authorities that he'd been rehabilitated. So he wanted to suggest that he's a good Muslim, and because he's a good Muslim, he's not going to be out there doing anything terrible. And again, that would fit perfectly with how we identify with him regarding being manipulative. So we get to 16 years later, almost 16 years later. He's spent more than half his life, of course, at this point incarcerated. And authorities decide, we don't think he's a threat. We don't think he's a threat to the public any longer. I'm going to tell you that if you have stone cold blooded killed an innocent dog walker in the most brutal of ways, where you dehumanize them, and you had a complete connection with the most sadistic type of material, including child sadistic material, I'm not sure that anyone in their right mind could ever suggest that you're not a threat to the public, genuinely. I mean, his actions in the past, they demonstrate a clear danger to the public. But they say, no, he committed the murder as a 15-year-old boy. He's now a 31-year-old adult. And he's changed. The classic, he's changed. So as part of the reintegration, McIntosh starts being allowed day release. That's important. You know, it's a big change from prison to being a civilian. And you have to arguably get back into the rhythm of accepting life as it is now versus as it was when you actually were incarcerated. Times have changed a great deal in that time. So it's essential that he is given this opportunity. So he gets released from Castle Huntly Prison on the 2nd of August 2017 whilst on home leave. This is 16 years, ironically, to the day that he murdered Anne Nicol. I will tell you, because I have studied this, that the professionals were confident, very confident, that he was fully rehabilitated. I actually think that's quite an arrogant description, genuinely. I don't know how you can express with such confidence that somebody who's carried out the crime that we've already talked about would ever be somebody who was fully rehabilitated. I mean, I imagine in rare circumstances, violent offenders can go on to live pro-social lives and make big differences to the community around them because they've realised what they did was wrong. But when we're talking about the hallmarks of a psychopath, and we are we really pretending that this guy is fully rehabilitated? We get to the 7th of August 2017. Let me put this in context, guys. The 7th of August 2017 is just 3 days off a parole hearing that could have seen him fully released from prison. 3 days away. Now that day, CCTV catches him leaving his mum's flat. This is in Bridgefoot, and it's shortly before midday. Now he's just casually strolling along. He's got a rucksack on his back. He actually smiles at a neighbour's dog who's playing in a driveway, and he's headed for Templeton Woods in Dundee. Immediately, your hackles go up, don't you? Hang on a minute. This guy's got a rucksack. He's going towards the woods. Oh, this doesn't feel okay. Now that afternoon, we've got 57-year-old Linda McDonald. She's just walking her dog in Templeton Woods as she has a right to safely. Now it's about 1:10 p.m. She notices that this is guy, and she describes it as a man walking purposefully towards her. It's McIntosh. Now he strides straight past her, but bear in mind, there's something about the way that he's walked that has kind of made her take notice. And she recognizes that he walks past her in this way. But then the footsteps stop. He turns. He takes a dumbbell bar with a weight on one end from the rucksack. And he just runs at Linda from behind. She just hears these footsteps approaching at speed. And before Linda even has a chance to register what's happened, McIntosh strikes her on the head with a weighted end of the dumbbell. Can you imagine the impact of that? Anybody who's ever picked up a dumbbell knows how catastrophic those things would be used as a weapon. She's immediately stunned by the force of the blow, and she can immediately feel blood running into her eyes and ears. She knows she's been badly injured. Bear in mind, the pain isn't registering. The adrenaline is just flooding through her system. But this is a really serious injury. She automatically turns, raises her hands in an attempt to stop him and to defend herself. And McIntosh just continues to hit her. He then grabs the clothing. He just pulls her to the ground. And bear in mind, you are most vulnerable when you are on the ground. They have full power. You don't have the opportunity to run. You are literally within their control. She's just screaming in terror. She shouts at him, please. Please, why are you doing this? And McIntosh is expressionless and emotionless, and he just ignores her pleas, and he just continues to hit her again and again with the dumbbell around her head, around her body. And she's screaming in agony. She's begging for her life. And she knows, without a shadow of a doubt, this man intends to kill her. This stranger that she doesn't know wants to execute her. And she knows in that moment, have one chance of survival, one opportunity to make it through this alive, and that is I'm going to make as much noise as possible. And you know what? That is so powerfully important to know. It's why I talk about do not comply all the time. It's not because a victim deserves to die. They do nothing wrong. If somebody is caught in the freeze when they are dealing with an attack, I appreciate that is not their fault. But there is something about this woman, and she realizes I've got to scream for my life. And she does. She refuses to comply. She screams at the top of her lungs. And at the end of the day, in this situation, it's her only hope. Now, bear in mind, he doesn't care. He's still going to carry on with the attack, even though she's being resistant and she's refusing to be quiet. And just like he had done with Anne 16 years earlier, he begins dragging Linda's battered body from the path into the undergrowth, because obviously that's going to make it more difficult for people to find them. She's drifting in and out of consciousness. And the only difference between what we talked about earlier with Anne and what we're talking about now with this attack is that with Anne, no one had been able to hear her screams for help because he'd cut the vital area that would have given her that volume. But for Linda, things are going to be different. And things are going to be different because of two heroic brothers, Charles and Peter Connor. They're walking the dogs nearby. They hear Linda's scream. They hear the dog barking. They know something terrible's happening and they run. They run to her aid, they run to her protection. They see McIntosh crouched down, leaning over Linda. McIntosh instantly realizes he's been discovered. These are two men, not a defenseless woman, and he just runs from the scene. Charles and Peter heroically save Linda's life. Aside from saving her in that moment, they then call emergency services to try their best to stem the bleeding. And she has been so severely injured. You know, later they're able to establish that she'd actually suffered two skull fractures. She got a really badly damaged thumb because obviously of the defense wounds. And she's been left with permanent scars, but she's still alive. She still gets to live another day. I mean, the trauma she's endured is catastrophic and horrific without a doubt. Life becomes vulnerable and it penetrates every action that you do for many years, sometimes for the rest of your life. But she's alive. And those men running towards her in that way, we have to take a step back and breathe out that feeling of absolute relief that these men just didn't stand and listen. They took action. They made a difference. They saved a life. Now, meanwhile, McIntosh, who's obviously realised he's been disturbed, makes his way back to his mother's flat. But let me tell you, we're not talking about somebody who's chaotic, who's afraid, who's realising that he's just done something that could compromise his freedom. No. CCTV cameras capture him again, strolling casually back, as if literally nothing has happened. He's got no conscience about this event. He's done what he wanted to do. He's got what he needed to get, and he's completely relaxed. Now, the police, obviously, when they find out that this woman has been brutally attacked and would have been murdered had it not been for the heroes that we've described and had it not been for her heroic actions to scream and cry and fight for her life in that way, the police know this has the hallmarks of somebody who's incredibly violent, and they look at the fact that McIntosh is on day release. And instantly he's a prime suspect for the attempted murder. First of all, he lives nearby. Obviously, they've connected that he's on day release from prison. And most importantly, the attack on Linda is kind of strikingly similar to that of Anne's murder 2 decades earlier. We've got a lone adult woman. She's walking a dog. She gets viciously attacked in a wooded area. The injuries are to her head and body. It seems to be very contextual and in line with the earlier murder. Now, at about 2:20 p.m., so this is within minutes of McIntosh arriving back at his mum's flat, the police are there. So it's a good police work, because this guy is so dangerous, they don't know whether he's going to strike again. When they actually find him, he's inside wearing blood-stained boxer shorts. I kid you not. Blood-stained boxer shorts. And of course, it's not his blood. We actually have CCTV footage that captures the officers leading him away in handcuffs. And There is no joy in that reality because of what's played out to eventuate that he needs those handcuffs on. But it is satisfying to know that his apprehension was so quick and that he's been banged to rights immediately. We get to October 2017, and of course, this is when he's in court, and McIntosh, he actually pleads guilty to Linda's attempted murder. Now, the psychiatric report identified psychopathic personality traits. No shit, Sherlock. I mean, did we need anybody to actually identify that? This guy's a cold-blooded killer. He's done it before. He's essentially relived exactly the same event with a different victim. Of course, he has psychopathic personality traits. They were very, very evident very early on in his life. And this report also highlighted that he presented a high risk of physical violence and psychological harm to the public, particularly adult females. Now, his defense, the person who was there to advocate for him, they said, listen, McIntosh can't actually offer any available words to explain, rationalize, or even mitigate his conduct. I can. You are a cold-blooded killer. You are a psychopath, a human predator. You are the worst of the worst of humanity. You are always going to be a horrific danger to our world. And I am so glad that you are behind bars, because you would certainly have killed your second victim. And if you hadn't been caught for that, you would have gone on and killed somebody else. You are certainly a serial killer in the making. It is as simple as that. Yes, your second victim did not die, so we cannot apply the actual definition to you, which is two or more killings with a cooling off period in between, but certainly he would have killed her if he'd had his way. And if he hadn't been apprehended, he'd done it again and again and again. So he's subsequently given an order for lifelong restriction. This is at the High Court in Aberdeen. Now, he will automatically be able to apply for parole after just 5 years. I have no idea why. Look, I appreciate that the judge, even in this case, made it clear that there was a distinct possibility he might never be released. But it does not bring me comfort that after 5 years, every time, he'll be able to apply for parole, because he's already hoodwinked the authorities before. People were confident that he was fully rehabilitated, where he didn't even make it to the point where he'd been properly released from prison and he attacked again. So it makes me very concerned that we're in a scenario where he even gets the opportunity to apply for parole. Why isn't he just being kept in prison forever without the possibility of parole? And the first attempt actually at parole is in August 2022. Now, unsurprisingly, his application is refused, but at the same time, it really makes me nervous that we're even having a conversation about him having the opportunity to apply for it anyway. Now, bear in mind that we have a living victim here. We have Linda. And she did get to survive this attack. And that's something that, unfortunately, the first victim never had the opportunity to do.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
But for Linda, life has changed dramatically. First of all, she actually endured the brutal attack. But since that day, she hasn't been able to work. Imagine being somebody who feels like a vital, pro-social, independent individual who's in our society, going about their business, living in the world, contributing. And then suddenly that's stolen from you. You don't get to go to work anymore. You don't get to apply all the skills that you've used. It's been stolen from you. She suffers from chronic pain. She suffers from dizziness. She suffers from sleeplessness. She has these awful flashbacks of the attack that nearly ended her life. And we can absolutely understand that post-traumatic stress disorder is something that you could expect to endure when you've literally had your whole sense of security destroyed, where a simple walk with the dog turned into a life-threatening occasion. But in spite of this, Linda's forgiven McIntosh, which again, I find unbelievably humbling when somebody can do that, genuinely. I mean, I'm more like Gordon, that if somebody had affected the life of somebody I love, I'd be like, maybe I'm just going to stalk this individual and, I don't know, find a way of making them disappear. But there are some amazing human beings like Linda who realise that, you know what, actually, if I don't forgive him, I'm going to be tied to that moment, tied to that brutal attack, and I'm not going to be able to move forward in my life. And I do find people like her absolutely astonishing. I really do. And it's just such a juxtaposition to the kind of person we're talking about. Where McIntosh is concerned, they're just polar opposites entirely. I will say she remains angry with a prison system that basically allowed a really dangerous predator to be released back on our streets. I mean, bear in mind, the professionals who worked with McIntosh prior to his day release were stunned at his actions. How can you be stunned at his actions? We were stunned. We were stunned at his actions. Can I ask you why you were stunned at his actions? Because he was fully rehabilitated. How do you have any evidence for that? Because he didn't do anything like he'd done before in prison whilst he was actually serving a sentence. Were there any women or children in prison? No. What's his profile offender victim type? Women and children? Yes, that's right, women and children. Also, did he actually attack somebody and murder them in cold-blooded scenario, insert himself in the investigation, try to get away with the murder, and actually feel a sense of thrill at doing the murder? Yes, that did happen. But he's completely rehabilitated, right? We believe so. You're confident on that? Very confident. I think you need to go on some training, sweetheart. Genuinely, how can you be confident? How can you be shocked? How can you be astonished when this kind of killing happens again by a person who, with respect, showed no mercy to his initial victim and enjoyed the thrill of what he did? They basically said, listen, there were no warning signs that he was going to reoffend. He didn't have any behaviours that were violent or attitudes that were negative whilst in prison. Apparently his conduct in prison and when he was on community leave had been positive. Also, he had, to be fair, been through loads of rigorous assessments before he'd been granted leave for home. But if you are a psychopath who's highly manipulative, then clearly you are going to be somebody who knows what to say, knows what to do to affect the goal that you are trying to reach, which is freedom. And this might not even have been freedom in the long term. This may just have been a culmination of fantasies that he had cooked up during his incarceration that led him to know that he just wanted another opportunity to kill. And he got it. He got it. The idea that psychopathic individuals cannot manipulate the ordinary person. And look, I appreciate they will absolutely stand by the fact that they tried. They did their best. They wanted to believe that he was rehabilitated. And that's one of the biases that people have. And I understand it. Reality-wise, if you're working in a prison, if you're trying your best to get these people reformed and you believe that you've managed that and attained that, it's going to give you this idea that you have a more positive slant on the probability of them becoming good citizens. But it can also be a real problem, because if you want to believe it so deeply, then you're going to act sometimes in a way that means you're not actually focused on reality. You're focused on hope. And for me, we have the hallmarks of a cold-blooded killer from day one, and I cannot imagine why they're surprised that this individual firstly manipulated them and secondly was happy to act out again. Also, they did an inquiry as well that did not shine a very positive light on how he'd been dealt with in the community. So they did this inquiry and they found out that the monitoring, when he'd been given home release, had been really substandard. Now, they established that this was because he fell into this kind of black spot. So he lived on the border of two different local authorities. So it seems that he was living in one local authority, but he was being monitored by another. Also, and again, ask yourself, why was access to this book even given? But after the attack on Linda, they find this fiction book about a lone male who attacked females in wooded areas. It was found in his cell. Sorry? Why are people getting books like that? Look, human rights, blah, 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 blah. Screw human rights when it comes down to the perpetuation of fantasy in these kind of killers. You know, people should monitor the kind of detail and information that these individuals have access to, because otherwise you're kind of sending them to school to incite further education in an area that is dark and malevolent. But yeah, he had that in his cell. And then he played it out in reality. Now, whole life terms are rare. You know that. But I think this one deserves it, genuinely. McIntosh clearly possesses an insatiable rage against women. You know, after committing this brutal murder on an innocent woman, she was just 15 years of age, he must have spent 16 years fantasizing about being released. Fantasizing about when he'd get the opportunity to reoffend, finally have the opportunity to carry out those dark desires again. Evidently, we have a very psychopathic mindset. It's exacerbated essentially by his incredibly highly sadistic mindset. And let me tell you, this guy has never expressed any remorse at all for these crimes. Why? Because he enjoyed them. Because he sat patiently behaving himself for 16 years so that he would have another option to go out and kill again. And the reason I think he deserves to rot in his cell is because he will spend another 15 years doing the same. And then he will go out and reoffend again. And another woman will either be brutalized or murdered. The truth is, whether the prison system would like to believe that it is always possible to rehabilitate, we all know it isn't. Some people cannot be rehabilitated. And Robin McIntosh, he's a grade A example of one of these. I hope that he spends the rest of his life frustrated that he finally cannot beat a system that he was so capable of beating in the period that we've explored today. We don't want any more of these victims. This man is a danger to society, a danger to women. And hopefully one day, when he takes his last breath, his maker will meet him and then take him quickly to the burning flames of hell, where he can endure, I don't know, the next billion years being burnt at a very, 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 very high temperature. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.